I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
I got nothing against a little drink, a little fun. But the law of the land shouldn't be for sale.
Buford Pusser, he became a legend in our time, and he never stopped walking tall.
You let them do this to me and get away with it, and you give them the eternal right to do the same damn thing to any one of you!
Walking Tall. Now, more than ever, you must see it. Walking Tall. Rated R. Under 17, not admitted without parent.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, little bit of a change of pace, away from politics, although maybe in a way this is political, as we delve into the story of the Dixie Mafia with true crime author Sonova Cantrell, who has written a book entitled Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. In it, she relays the story of this Southern fried criminal syndicate, which was involved in activities ranging from arson to murder for hire plots. Famously, the Dixie Mafia was portrayed on the big screen in the Walking Tall movies, starring such actors as Joe Don Baker, Bo Svenson, and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, all of whom played the tough-as-nails sheriff Buford Pusser, who waged a one-man war in real life against the Dixie Mafia. Well, the true story is going to be told of both the Dixie Mafia and Buford Pusser on this edition of the program, as well as discussing the case of a woman, Phyllis Anderson, who has been on a search for justice after the death of her brother took place at the hands of, she believes, the Dixie Mafia. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views with true crime writer Sonova Cantrell, author of Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. Welcome to Parallax Views. Sonova Cantrell of the Missouri Missing Organization, author of such books as Unorganized Crime, and the new book, Silenced by the Dixie Mafia. How are you doing, Sonova?
I'm fabulous. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. I like the fedora. I hear you're known for that.
Yeah, I am. I am. That was an author brand I stumbled onto early on, and now if I dare make a picture or a video without it, someone has to call me or harass me about it. So it's fine. Now I don't have to fix my hair. I just wear a hat.
So for my listeners that may be unfamiliar, maybe you can tell them a little bit about your previous work before writing about the Dixie Mafia. I was interested in hearing about the Unorganized Crime book real briefly.
Sure. Well, I've been a writer professionally for over a decade. I started out as a freelance journalist, and then I had written two books in other genres, and I was traditionally published, and of course, I had gotten the traditional horrible contracts and was just basically waiting for them to expire. And in the meantime, I had came across a gentleman named Sidney Hurd. He was an ex-gangster from Chicago, and he wanted someone to write his biography. Well, at that time, I was very naive. I had no idea that about organized crime or anything like that. I had barely heard of The Godfather. And yet, this guy had 4 hours worth of stories he told me in this restaurant. And I was trying to keep my poker face on, and I didn't have a poker face. I was trying to just, you know, not let this guy know that he was blowing my mind with all these insane stories. So I kind of shrugged my shoulders and I said, so what? You got ties to organized crime or what? You know, trying to sound cool and act like, you know, he wasn't, you know, scaring me to death with all this stuff he was talking about. And he looked down at me with these steel cool blue eyes. And he says, well, sis, if I'd been organized, I wouldn't have been caught. And that's where our book title comes from. So we laugh about that, you know, all these years later. But that is actually the biography of an ex-gangster from Chicago. He wasn't Italian, so he created his own family and his own organization. His aunts were married into the Italians. He was raised amongst the Italian mafia. But since he wasn't, you know, his bloodline wasn't Italian, he couldn't actually be a made man. So he said that's okay, and he created his own organization and did a little bit of everything short of murder. And so that's what that book is about. He counterfeited gold coins from Africa. He broke out of prison several times. Bank robbery, counterfeiting, everything you can imagine, with the exception of murder. He said he never had it in him to murder anyone. He said he just wanted to make money, have a good time, show the girls good time, that kind of thing. And so that book is, I would say, I'll be honest with you, I think it's got more action and more adventure than the Catch Me If You Can, that everyone knows, the Frank Abagnale story. I was already in the middle of researching this project with Sydney when that came out. And when I read his biography, I got bored, because Frank Abagnale was known to do the same thing over and over and over again, and he was successful. Well, Sydney did everything. He was the Amarillo arsonist for 22 years, was never caught. He helped change the law of our land twice in the two different Supreme Court decisions. Everything you can imagine this guy did, and did it successfully. And in fact, they wouldn't have brought him down if 78 of his so-called friends hadn't decided to turncoat on him. And that was what they were going to base their indictments on. And so he's like, nope. So then he decided to flip and become undercover operative for the FBI and the DEA. So he flipped and did the other side of the fence. So that is definitely all kinds of adventure and white collar crime and chaos is what I call that. So, but that one is definitely adventurous. But that's what got me started into true crime, really.
So what led you to write about the Dixie Mafia? And maybe before that, people know about the Italian mobsters and the Jewish mobsters and Irish mobsters. But if you say Dixie Mafia, they may be unfamiliar. I know some people that are interested in subjects like the Martin Luther King assassination have talked about the Dixie Mafia. But a lot of other people don't know what this is. What do we mean when we say the Dixie Mafia?
Well, that's one thing that I have to kind of go up against a lot. It's almost somewhat of a battle, because people don't want to recognize that there is organized crime outside of these traditional realms. And I really feel like it's because Hollywood has dramatized and fantasized and romanticized the Italians, the Jewish, but then the Dixies, they've basically left alone. And so you'll find in your pattern of research, if you research these things for many, many decades, the Italians, as everybody said, no, there's no such thing as an Italian mafia. There's no such thing. That was what kept them, that's what made them prosperous, was no one would admit it. Well, now we're finding that same pattern with the Dixies. And so basically, I always go back to this intelligence report, and I apologize, you might hear the snapping of my binder here. I'm going to show you the first page. This is a legitimate intelligence report about the Dixie Mafia. It is actually was created, and we think that this might be something new that's coming up. This is something back in 1974 prepared by the Office of the Attorney General Vern Miller for the state of Kansas. It's an intelligence report solely based on the Dixie Mafia. And it is absolutely chock full of investigators, reports from various parts of the South. And they're just trying to get someone to pay attention, say, hey, this is a legitimate deal. There, this is bigger, widespread. This is, you know, when you hear grassroots organization, that perfectly explains the Dixie Mafia. And so they're trying desperately to get someone to listen to us, say, hey, listen, this needs to be investigated. This is a bigger deal than you realize. And basically it went unheard, you know, and so it went on deaf ears. But I put this on the back of my book. Let me go ahead and turn to it in this report. And I pulled this from straight up from this report. So this has not been edited or doctored in any way. This is a quote by Agent James Duff of the Georgia State Organized Crime Intelligence Unit. Now, like I said, this was compiled and sent in 1974, so in the first part of the 70s. This is what he had to say about this unknown group of organized criminals. There is no other group anywhere in the country as mobile and as well organized as the Dixie Mafia. So this is something that a law enforcement, an organized crime intelligence officer, if he's an organized crime intelligence unit, he knows all about the Italians, he knows about the Irish, he knows about all these, and yet he is saying in this report, and I will give you a link if you want to, you know, to put it in your comments so your listeners can look it up. This report can be downloaded off the internet. It is part of the Kansas Library Archives, and it says Kansas State Library Archives in Topeka. So this is public knowledge, and yet it's been forgotten. This man, taking into account the Italians and everybody, he still says that there's nobody as mobile and as well organized as the Dixies. And so that I found was shocking to me, because I hadn't even heard of them before until I ran into this case. Those of you that don't follow me and haven't heard of me, I work as a victims advocate with Missouri Missing Organization. And to help them, what I do is I use my writing ability and my marketing ability to help bring these obscure cold cases to light that have been forgotten by mainstream media. So that's how I volunteer. And a couple years ago, a lady approached me. Both her little crippled little brother and her father had been murdered by members of the Dixie Mafia.
This is Phyllis Anderson, right?
Yes, yes. This is the very first time I'd ever heard of the Dixie Mafia. I'd never heard of it before that. So before 2 years ago, I was in the dark about this. And so that's what got me started on this journey of research about the Dixie Mafia. And yes, they were involved in the plot to kill Martin Luther King. They were also involved in the Klan and the KKK. So there was a lot of lynchings and horrendous crimes, you know, of racial hatred type crimes that you could tie to Dixie Mafia members. And so there's a lot of history about this. It's just not been talked about. And so that's kind of what got me started in the Dixie Mafia. Basically, it is a group of organized criminals. They say in this report here, and in one out of Dallas, there was some other reports out of Dallas, that there was basically 220 core members, and they traveled all across the southern United States, all the way from coast to coast, and they literally worked with individuals in each area for specialized things. So if you were a specialist at, you know, breaking open safes, or if you were a specialist in bomb making, or if you were a specialist in arson, then it's like they worked with a whole bunch of freelance criminals. And so when you go back and dig through all these cases, you'll find each one of them, there's at least one or two familiar names that will revert back to that main core group of 220. And so I don't know where they get that number, because those names, as far as I can tell, have been lost to history. But there are a good 25, 30 that I know of and that I can trace. And some of them are still alive in the penitentiary for life. One of the main names you hear when you look anything up about the Dixie Mafia is Kirksey Nix Jr. And he is actually still in prison for life. And of course, he's not talking about anything. He refuses to talk about this. But that is one of those 220 that they list in the intelligence report out of Dallas.
So I want to touch on this real briefly. You mentioned they were involved with the KKK and these other things. I guess the first thing I wanted to get at was the Dixie Mafia ideological? Like, it sounds like they harbored a lot of racists, but were they mainly about money, or were they mainly about racism and politics? It sounds like it was more money, ultimately.
Well, and this, I kind of go back and I try to explain what I've studied about the Italians. Now, people want to compare them to the Italians because the Italians are the most well-known. You know, they're the ones that Hollywood always loves to make movies about. And so the way the Italians were set up, it started out as La Cosa Nostra, which is our thing. It came back all the way over here from Sicily. It started out as an ideal. It started out as a family. And everything that was done, all the rules that were set, all the hierarchy that was put in place with the Italians, was because the family, the organization, came first. And that was part of the thing. They would tell you, if you come into this life, we call you, your wife's on her deathbed, you have to leave your wife and come to us because we're first. Okay. But then the whole structure was to make it to where the money and the profit, the whole concept was this, I hate to use the word brotherhood because it's kind of but that's basically what it was. It was all about our family, our thing. And so everything centered around the profitability of the group. Well, you have to take that ideal and flip it on its head when you're talking about the Dixie Mafia. See, the Italians had rules in place because they didn't necessarily, it wasn't necessarily that they, you know, were this big moralistic group. It was because they didn't want to bring in too much heat from law enforcement and they wanted to minimize the inner fighting. Okay, so you wasn't supposed to touch a made man's wife or his daughter. You weren't supposed to kill a judge or a public official. All those little rules were because they didn't want to bring more heat on the organization. Well, in the Dixie Mafia, it was all about the individual. It was all about how much money can I make? Am I tougher than you? Do I have more firepower than you? If you have something that I want, I'm going to take it. You can't stop me. And so basically, there was groups of individuals that worked together on certain jobs, and then they traveled about. But each county, each section, each area would have a so-called boss of sorts that would run the criminal enterprise in that county. But
this involves stuff like moonshine, bootlegging, gambling, dogfighting, all that.
Yes, and murder for hire. The main thing that changes the Dixies from the Italian way of thinking to the Dixie way of thinking, it was all about the big I in the Dixies. They had no rules. They didn't care to kill officials because they had bought off everybody. You're talking about in a time in history where the South suffered greatly in poverty. So they wouldn't go to, you know, the big cities where people were being prosperous. They would go to these little rural communities where the county sheriff might not be able to feed his own family. And so that guy would be easier to pay. They would pay these county officials and things a year's worth of wages a month just to say, hey, don't pay attention to us. You know, and if you can't feed your children, that might be a hard decision for you to make.
I was going to say, it sounds a little bit like a more serious version of what you see in I wonder if younger people are going to get this reference, my younger listeners, but it sounds like the Dukes of Hazzard and Boss Hogg, except not funny, incompetent Boss Hogg, but, you know, something much scarier.
Yeah. Well, and see, that's why I even use that as a reference point, because the way they're kind of painted out as bumbling buffoons, you know, Boss Hogg and Roscoe. But that's basically the way it worked. If you were coming into the fictional, you know, Hazzard County, you wanted to do something illegal, you better run it by Boss, or Boss is going to send out his law enforcement to arrest you, you know, because he had paid Roscoe off, you know, and Roscoe was his lackey. Now, of course, that is, they're literally bumbling buffoons, you know, and it's all comedy. But the thing is that kind of gives you an idea of the structure of how this worked down there. But then one thing that all of these intelligence reports agree on is the viciousness of these people. There was one quote, and I don't know where I put it. It's not, I didn't grab it. It's one quote. Oh, here it is. I'll look through this while we talk. They were so much more vicious than the Italians because they didn't have the rules. And you basically became a higher up in the Dixie Mafia if you could survive the longest. So it wasn't about, you know, so-and-so is the boss and next person is the capo and the next. No, it was about, are you tough enough to survive? And if they wanted your woman, they'd come in and take her. If you did anything about it, you were dead. You know, if they wanted what you had, and that's what made them so, a lot of people didn't want to even go into it because they were terrified. Because if the county wasn't already bought off, they may just be too scared to mess with it. And I'm not sure if I'm going to find that quote, but basically it was another investigator that said they would rather deal with the Italians because at least the Italians have rules. The Dixies were too vicious. There are a lot of cases where the Italians would literally hire out the Dixies for murder for hire jobs because basically the Italians had rules. And if this was going to muddy the waters between, you know, Boss and of the different families, or if this wasn't quite according to their rules, there is a lot of instances where they would hire the Dixies to do it because they couldn't kill this person because of their rules, but they knew someone that was crazy enough to do it. And that is the thing. And when you're talking about viciousness, there was a lot of people in this area that, you know, they were terrified of these people, but on the other hand, they were so impoverished that when these people came to town and they opened up a business, it actually bettered the community, you know? And so it really made it hard for people to want to take down this so-called bad guy, because look at what all he's done for the community.
Not to interrupt you, but I was going to say, it's sort of like, you know, if you read about Pablo Escobar, the drug kingpin, you find out that he gave money back to the community as a way to keep people from going after him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see, that's the thing. When you don't have anything and you are in that state of poverty, it's really hard to maintain this this moral compass that people like to put on you, because you're like, hey, my children are starving. I haven't been able to put a decent meal on the plate in a year. And this guy just offered me a year's worth of wages to just look the other way and not pay attention to his guys. You know, when your children are starving and you're a parent, that's a really hard decision to make, you know. And so this is what they dealt with. And there's, just to kind of give you the viciousness of these people, I keep saying vicious. There was a band that really stuck together. And in this band, there was a psychotic serial killer. I would call him a serial killer because he didn't just kill for money or kill for someone got in his way. He literally stalked his prey. He thrived off of it. He got off, you know, on it. He enjoyed the process. And there's a few in there that that really I could give you four or five names, but that I feel were more had the psychology of a serial killer. But anyways, this little group, there was a gypsy camp in New Orleans that was just outside of town, and it was just a bunch of trailers in a campground area, and it was during Mardi Gras. And part of the Dixies, there's this rumor going around that they had a safe in this gypsy camp that had $100,000 or more in it. And we're talking, you know, 70s, that's a lot of money. Well, so they decide they timed it to where all of the men were out in doing Mardi Gras. And basically all that was left at camp was the elderly taking care of the children. So there was a few women and then the elders and the children. So they hit this camp. They terrorized the camp. They chained everybody up. They beat people up for hours trying to get them to tell them where this safe was. They called her the Gypsy Queen. Her name was Margie George. They tortured her, and she kept saying, "There is no safe. We don't have a safe." And they refused to believe her. Well, there's little evidence to show that the other guys were wanting to leave and take what they could find. They ended up with, I don't know, $12,000 worth of jewelry and stuff. There's no way of knowing exactly how much, because the gypsies didn't give wouldn't give a specific amount because of tax purposes. They didn't want it to show up on their taxes. So anyways, but there was one of these black clad men in, one of these men got viciously angry and just lost his mind. And he started hacking her with a hacksaw, with an axe, and literally almost just buried it in her head. And she wasn't dead yet. And one of the guys had to pull him away and shot her to put her out of her misery. And then they ran off after that. But this is one of those men that had that psychology of a serial killer. And there are a few books out there about him and some of his cohorts. But this is the type of people we're talking about. They literally, you don't give them what they want, whether you have it or not, and they will literally cut you in half with an axe. I mean, that's kind of what these people were made of. And this guy, they don't know for sure which one it is, but just from that behavior, I believe I know which one it was, because he has had some of that extreme violent behavior before in some other cases. Of course, they never did solve that case. The couple witnesses that did come forward say they listed a few guys they thought may have been involved. He ended up in a ditch along the highway. So there's really no way of knowing for sure unless this person had confessed on his deathbed to his grandkids. So that's the reason why I'm hesitant to say his name, because he does have grandkids. Until there's more proof. But if you read everything that I've put out, you could probably figure it out. Let's just put it that way. If you read my blog about all the Dixies, you could probably figure out who I'm talking about.
Well, I want to get into the origins of the Dixie Mafia with the State Line Mob. But before we do that, I have to do a side quest here. Sure. Because I did not know about – there's a connection tying the Dixie Mafia to the breakup of the Allman Brothers Band. What is that story?
Yes. Well, see, people want to think that the Dixies don't exist. And that's the way they have flown under the radar for so long, is because no one wants to believe that this band of rednecks, they call them the cornbread, La Cosa Nostra, they call them, you know, the hillbillies. I mean, they call them everything under the sun. The point is, they're all white men from the South, and they were very intelligent. So, you know, you want to say hillbillies and rednecks and all these things gives a connotation of ignorance. They were very brilliant. There was nothing ignorant about them.
When you say brilliant, do you mean, because people are going to say, okay, were they educated in were they brilliant in that way, or was it in another way?
There was a good eclectic mix of education. Kirksey Nix was the son of an extremely prominent judge by the same name, Kirksey Nix, out of Oklahoma. You can read about him. He had a very, very educated background. He was very, he was raised upper middle class. I mean, so he wasn't from an impoverished family. He had a good education, a good background, but this is the life he chose, you know. Then you have some that were very brilliant in, like, the criminal mastermind, the scheming way of thinking. You have, like, Towhead White, which was a good friend of Kirksey Nix's. He actually was more of the schemer. And so he was brilliant he was good at making connections all across the states. And so so you see a good intelligence in, you know, in bookwork wise and in, you know, in street smarts. And so then there was, of course, the some that were just, you know, the thugs that they had to do their dirty work. You know, there's always that, you know, little bit of hierarchy. You know, there was always the brain versus brawn type, you know, argument. But so, yeah, there are some that was very well educated in actual academia, I guess how you say that. And then there was some that was just really educated in the street life. And quick side note, Towhead White actually started out when he was a teenager. He was a driver for the Italian mob boss, Carlos Marcello. And so he, I think, picked up a lot of stuff from the Italians. So, that's kind of, that's the reason why I call them intelligent, because they're not just going out and doing, you know, all these crimes. They actually plan it. There's organization going in it. There's a lot of, they have planned this out. I mean, they had to be intelligent to be able to get away with all this for so long.
So the Allman Brothers thing, I didn't mean to take you off track there.
No, you're fine. Grab a drink of my water here. The Allman Brothers. Okay, so everyone knows that they took down the Italian mafia with the RICO Act. But what they don't realize was that was not the first time it was successfully used against an organized crime family. It was used 3 years before that in Georgia against a Dixie Mafia drug kingpin who had connections with the Allman Brothers. And so that is where that story came in. So they actually used the RICO Act, the first indictment in the U.S. with the RICO Act against the mob boss was actually a Dixie mob boss. And so that is where it goes. But you have I have to look back to get all the details on it, but basically that happened 3 years before. Now, let me look it up real quick, because I run 300 or more cases a year, so I'll have to look it up to get all my details straight. But the Allman Brothers had their roadie, and he was the one that supposedly was supplying drugs to the group, okay? And I'm going to look it up real quick so I can give you all the details. So they were going to take down this mob boss for drugs. And the roadie was actually the one that was supplying drugs to the group. And here's what happened. When that roadie came up, one of the Allman Brothers decided to kind of turncoat on the roadie. Everyone loved this guy, but he went ahead and went against the grain and was going to witness against this guy. Well, this guy ends up going down, the roadie goes down, and everyone of the other side of the fence was believing that the roadie didn't actually do it, that it was actually one of the Allman Brothers, and he was taking the fall for it. And so that is what it is. They were called, of course, the Godfather of Southern Rock. At the time, this was October 29th, in the October 1971. Now, they wanted to take down the roadie, but the boss they were trying to get was named J.C. Hawkins. And I have my blog post pulled up so I can get all my details straight. But they had, they wanted to take down J.C. Hawkins. Well, Greg Allman was the one that had decided that he was going to go ahead and testify against Scooter. Scooter was the roadie that brought all the drugs and everything. Well, half of the group really thought that Scooter was taking the heat for Greg. Okay, and they felt like that Greg should have kept his mouth shut and let the government take down Scooter and the drug J.C. Hawkins on his own. And since Scooter, they tried to turn Scooter and make Scooter be a witness against J.C. Hawkins. Well, Scooter refused to rat out anybody, okay? And so he ended up going to jail for this, and he ended up spending some time there. And Scooter actually, it says Scooter Herring was convicted of 5 drug charges and sentenced to a whopping 75 years in prison because of this. And yet he wouldn't turn on J.C. Hawkins, and he wouldn't turn on Greg Allman either. And so after that whole ordeal, the whole band, the whole group just split up, and they literally, they tried to come together periodically after that, but there was that deep-seated resentment between them because everyone felt like Scooter took the fall for Greg. And so that's kind of the basic, you know, gist of it. But I did a whole long article on it like 2 years ago when I first wrote about it. But that's how the Dixie Mafia came in between the Allman Brothers and broke them up. So
it's interesting, all the connections that pop up. That's the only reason I mentioned it. But we got to get into, I guess, the State Line Mob and the Hathcocks. I want to talk about them. And a note to people, we're going to be talking about Buford Pusser from the Walking Tall films, which if people haven't seen those, they're a lot of fun. One of them has The Rock in it, the wrestler. But, you know, the true story may be a little bit different than the movie. But who were the Hathcocks?
Okay, well, and this is something that I have learned very, you know, the hard way. There are people that still to this day worship Buford Pusser as if he was deity. And there are some people out there that hate him and demonize him as well. So in my book that, you know, that I wrote, I was very kind of middle of the road. I brought out the facts. I brought out different things. But I tell you, I'll be honest with you, he wasn't no saint. And 90% of the stuff you see in the Walking Tall movies, if you actually research Buford Pusser, they aren't true. So Hollywood took this rugged rural county sheriff and made him into this hero. And then now people, even to this day, will fight you if you tarnish his name, you know. And I'm one of those, there's other people that will get on there and just, you know, badmouth him every day of their life. And I try to have a little bit more class about me, if you want to be honest. It's not classy to rag on a dead guy for the rest of your life. You know, I find something else.
Why do they rag on him? Is it that he didn't always play by the rules?
He did not play by the rules. Now, we are talking about back in a day and age where you say strong arm of the law, that meant a fist in your face. You are talking about back in a day where law enforcement didn't even have as many rules as they have today. You're talking about a rural county where, the law enforcement fought fire with fire. Okay, so you have to realize this is back in another era of progression, I guess you can call it. But you lived and died as a man by how tough you were. If you lived by your grit. And if you were a sheriff, you showed the bad guys that you were tougher than them. That's how you subdued them. He didn't worry about the law. And he took it to extremes. So we'll put it this way. But then there's some times where you read about these people, that were calling his house and terrifying his wife and his daughter with threats about killing them and throwing their bodies in the swamp. And then he goes and finds the guy, he hunts him down, he makes him crawl through the swamp in his big, $1,000 suit. He makes him crawl on his hands and knees, handcuffed through the swamp until he, all night long, at gunpoint, and then takes him home. Now, is that legal? No, not any way, shape, or the form. But as a human, I'm sitting here going, heck yeah, you know, there's part of you that almost applauds that. And that's what Hollywood grabs onto, and that's what makes a good movie. But then on the other side of the things, that's not legal at all. You know, he should have arrested that man, put him in jail, let the law take care of it. But you have to, you have to be a pretty, I have to be honest with people. When I first read about that story of him making Towhead White crawl through the swamp, there was part of me that cheered him on. I'm like, heck yeah. You know, if I seen that in a movie, I'll be like, that's awesome, you know. But that's vigilante justice. That's not what our legal system is supposed to do, you know. And so there was a lot of things that he did like that did make people hate him.
Well, these rural areas, you know, they were sort of Wild West. It's not like the city.
Right. And two, you watch the movie, and this is, again, I'm showing my age, Tombstone, with Wyatt Earp and all them. The reason why we tell those stories is because, there's something in our core that we can really grasp onto. But was Wyatt Earp a saint? No. You know, did he do things by law? No. You know, but when you make a movie like Tombstone, everybody loves it. You know, it's because down at our core, I think part of us in our psychology, we wished we could do something like that. You know, when someone hurts us, there's something down deep in their primal that makes us want to hurt them back, you know? But then we have to be mature enough to say, that's not the legal way to do it, you know, and not vigilante justice is not acceptable in our country, you know. And but I have to be honest with you, there's part of me that was, you know, excited about that part, you know. But yeah, Buford Passer was really bad about walking outside of the law. Did you have a question?
I was gonna say there's a really good story in the book that shows it's not always as glamorous as the movies either. There's a story about him having a confrontation with two people in a car. I don't know if you can relate that or, you know, just give a basic overview.
Yes. Now, see, people on, I have to deal with a lot of internet trolls, but I'm a kid from the 80s, okay? And I've learned, maybe it's because I was before the internet, you learn to watch your mouth, because you never said the things that people dare to say on, you know, behind a computer screen, because you would get your teeth knocked out. You know, and in some ways, I wish we could go back to that a little bit, because then it would make people use some sense before they, you know, become internet trolls and start saying all these things they know nothing about, you know. But there's a lot of people saying, well, he was horrible, he was vicious, he was a bully with a badge. And I'm saying, yes, but here is a good example of the kind of people he had to go up against. And he was actually... in this, you know, rural community, there was a house fire, and this elderly gentleman, his house was on fire, and he was They brought him out. I'm not sure if he lived or died. I think he may have died even. I mean, it was a brutal fire and everything was on fire around there. And Buford Pusser was just directing traffic down this dirt road, or this small road, trying to keep people away so that everybody could get in there and try to put the fire out. Well, while he was doing this, he turned and there was this car that the back end axle was dragging the ground, like it was about to drag the ground. And he's like, that's moonshine. And so he tries to get them to pull over and to go around. Well, when he sees that, he tries to pull them over. He says, you need to pull over. I need to see what's in that trunk. And they pull over, and just long enough for him to get to their window. Okay. He gets to their window and they act like they're going to take off. So you've seen that Hollywood move where the sheriff reaches in and grabs the car keys. Well, he tries that. Okay. And Buford Pusser is a huge guy. He is 6'6". He was an ex-wrestler, ex-Marine. He's a big guy. Okay. He reaches in there and tries to pull out the car keys. The woman in the passenger seat, he's stuck in the window. The guy takes off down the highway. He floors the car, dragging Buford Pusser along with him. So his upper body is in the car. The woman starts beating him with a wrench, okay, beating the guy on the head. This is the sheriff. She's beating him, giving him a concussion with a wrench. The man driving with one hand grabs a knife out of his pocket and is stabbing the sheriff. Okay, so the sheriff is dragged, I think, is several hundred yards down the road, being beaten and stabbed before he can finally get his upper body out of the car and falls to the ground and the car takes off. So we're talking, this is the type of people that he is dealing with. Yeah. And so these aren't innocent little, you know, church choir people that are, you know, having Sunday picnics. These are people that will kill you for trying to pull them over to see what's in their trunk. And so this is just a one time. He was shot and shot seven times and stabbed eight, or shot eight and stabbed seven times. I get them backwards. But this is the kind of thing he had to deal with. And at the time, when he first started, he was the only law enforcement there was. There was no deputies. And so you've got this area of the state line between Tennessee and Mississippi that was just Wild West is a good name for it. They were basically anything goes, and basically you had the sheriffs that were bought off, or the sheriffs that were just so small of a unit that they didn't have enough to combat it. And then you have this big honking ex-wrestler who decides he's going to take them on with his fists.
You know, Buford the Bull, right? That was his wrestling name. I mean, Buford that's a good way to sum him up. He's the Bull, you know.
He's the Bull, you know. When he was a wrestler, they called him Buford the Bull. And that's the way he is. He went in, hard and fast, and he waged war on these people. Now, Hollywood made it out that he cleaned up the state line mob and he did all this. In reality, the state line mob burnt themselves out. They were constantly waging war with law enforcement, and Buford Pusser and Towhead White ended up fighting to the death, basically. Buford Pusser died later in a fiery car crash, which people still try to say is an accident, but I had the son of a Dixie Mafia mob boss tell me his father told him in a jailhouse confession that that was not an accident. So I just have to take that for what it is. I can't prove it. But to me, there was a lot of things. There was a lot of suspicious calls beforehand. And the bad thing now is Buford Pusser's dead. His daughter, Diwana, is dead.
And they killed his wife, right?
Okay, yes. That is what Hollywood made the movie about. There was an ambush on New Hope Road, August 12th. That's where the book came from, August 12th. And there's people who said that he staged this himself because his wife was going to leave him, and so he killed her and shot his own face off. I don't think Buford was that I'm sorry. I don't know any man that's going to shoot their own face off. I'm sorry. I don't believe it. But anyways, Buford Pusser got a call in the wee hours of the morning before daylight that there was some kind of rambunction down on New Hope Row. Normally, he took these, drunk and disorderly calls all the time. His wife rode with him. It's no big deal. He was going to go take care of this guy. Usually that meant bodily throw them in the back of the police car and take them to jail. And then he was going to take his wife to breakfast. That was the idea. But it actually turned out to be an ambush. And there was an ambush car, a dark colored Cadillac, that followed them and pinned them, ran them off the road, and shot the whole car up. And the basic public story is that this one car followed them, shot them up. He slammed on the gas. He shrunk down his seat, slammed on the gas, and tried to outrun them, because every car he had, he always ramped up the motors in. And so it was very hard to catch Buford Pusser most of the time. But anyways, he hit the gas and he tried to outrun him. He made it a couple miles down the road in front of the cemetery, and he pulls over to check on his wife because she was laying in his lap. Well, she was already gone. She had been shot in the head and she was gone. He thought it was safe to check on her. He's trying to check on her. They catch up to him. They plow the thing with bullets, shoot him in the face, knock his jaw almost completely off of his body. It's literally laying on his chest. They said when they found the car that it looked like the car had almost been decapitated with the bullets. I mean, they had almost severed the top of the car off. It had been shot so many times, it looked like it was in a war zone. And so basically what happened, Buford still, I mean, he's this Buford the Bull. He still has the wherewithal, I'm going to get these guys. And so he literally grabs the steering wheel. He starts to try to take off, and he grabs his radio and tries to call in. And that's when he realizes, holy crap, I can't say anything. And he looks it up in the mirror, and his face is gone. It's just bloody pulp. And he makes it another couple miles down the road before his probably the adrenaline wears off. He makes it down the road another couple miles, but his garbled message is actually picked up by another sheriff who knows him and hears his and can understand something's wrong, and that's Buford. And so he runs down to where he calls the jailhouse and finds out where Buford was going. And then he intersects Buford because Buford's trying to drive back this way. And then he ends up finally slumping over the dash. But then there's a little bit of a conspiracy there, because, and that it's outlined in my book, because when he was first being wheeled into surgery, he said there were two cars. And then after all the 12 surgeries and all of the chaos and everything, it came down to one car. And the public story is it was all one car. But if you read my book, you'll find out that it was actually two cars. Buford wasn't the target. His wife was. And we know where the car went. We also have a good idea where the guns went, because it was never solved. The case still is not solved to this day. That's where this whole Phyllis Anderson story starts weaving into it. And that's what I think is so interesting about the Dixie Mafia stories. I call it a grassroots deal because it is literally that. Everything is so entangled into 100 other things that you can't just tell one Dixie Mafia story and be done.
I was going to say in that regard, and if we can cover this briefly, these two aspects, the Phyllis Anderson thing, and then I wanted to talk about the Hathcocks really briefly if we could, because the Hathcocks tie into Carl Towhead White, right, and that is how you get the connection to Buford Pusser. So right, who were the Hathcocks, and how does this end up getting Pusser involved with Towhead?
Yes, And then it goes all the way into, that is the connection that gets it all the way into what's later known as the Dixie Mafia, because up at this time, it's still called the State Line Mob. The Hathcocks, Jack and Louise Hathcock, they actually ran several clubs around the state line. One of them, the most infamous, was the Shamrock Motel and Restaurant. And the restaurant was on one side of the border, the motel was on the other side of the border, and they would lure tourists in with a very cheap homemade breakfast that, you know, really tasted good and everything, but it was very cheap. And so they would get people to stay in their hotel, and then a lot of times if they looked like they had money, or worse yet, if they were from the north, it looked like they were northerners, because Louise Hathcock didn't think the Civil War was over. And so they would, they called them Yankees. They said if they looked like they had money, or if they were Yankees, those dirty Yankees is what she'd always call them. But anyway, they would drug them. And when they got back to their hotel room, they would rob them of everything they had. And so it was like date, rape, drug minus the rape. They would drug them and rob them. And, they made several thousand dollars a month by doing that. Just that, besides all of the illegal things that they had going on, like the moonshine and the prostitution. Which there's some conspiracy about the prostitution, because some people you talk to on one side of the fence say that there was it was just a massive house of prostitution. Another side of the fence says, well, they had a few girls they could call in from other areas if someone wanted a girl, kind of thing. So I don't know. But basically, Jack and Louise Hathcock were married. Louise didn't love Jack. She never really did. She just thought he was her ticket out of poverty.
Can I comment on that real quick?
Yeah.
I was going to say, Louise Hathcock is a very interesting character to me in this story, because I mean, she's really vicious. Mm-hmm. At the same time, part of me almost, I don't know, pities her, because she does come from poverty, and she sees her ticket out as, mm-hmm. you know, seducing the men around her and right. getting with Jack. Right. But she is a very vicious person. Right. And I think near the end of her life, it all comes tumbling down, and maybe right. she had regrets, but go on.
Right. And see, it's the same thing. Like when we are watching this movie about Buford Pusser, we find ourselves, voting for this sheriff, you know, we find ourselves really going, you know, it's the same thing with Louise. We find ourselves really rooting for her, even though she wasn't really the nicest person, you know, but there's also a lot of conspiracy around her that maybe she wasn't as vicious as her legend declared it to be. And she wanted it that way, to protect herself. So, you know, she became very known as very vicious. She carried in her apron, she carried a ticket book, a pencil, a pistol, and she also carried a ball peen hammer. And there were lots of incidents where she would find her bouncers, you might say, weren't winning a fight, and she would just come up behind the person and beam them with that ball peen hammer, and they'd go down. I mean, you get hit in the head with a hammer, you're down. And she had no qualms about that. Now, P.D. Plunk was the deputy of Buford Pusser, and there's a newspaper article where he's quoted as saying he would rather have Al Capone gunning for him than Louise Hathcock. And that's in a newspaper printed, you know. So I'm thinking, she had to be somewhat vicious for a law enforcement officer to say that. Now, was she literally internally that vicious, or was that a facade she allowed to be built around her to protect herself? I don't know. There's also stories where she had come from extreme poverty. Jack had lots of money and he was going places. So she married him because he was, you know, he had the connections. She became very well off, and she would help other people, you know. It seemed like at one point she was very flirtatious, very vivacious. She wanted to manipulate the men around her for her own gain, which that's not good. But you see a change in her personality right after her marriage. There was an incident where she was supposedly cheating on Jack. He finds a friend they chase her down and beat her almost to the point of death. Okay. And then of course, law enforcement was paid off and nothing was done about it. And she was forced to return home. After that point right there, you see, it was almost like something broke in her and nobody was going to hurt her ever again. And so you almost find yourself, rooting for her. You're like, yeah, you know, no one's going to beat her up again. But then she just became more vicious as time went on.
Well, she even went after Jack eventually because Jack was going to give his inheritance to his daughter, Susan.
Right. Right. Well, see, she didn't love Jack. But she did actually fall in love with a guy, and Jack found out about it. And even though Jack was in a restaurant eating with a friend and there was lots of witnesses around, she knew that Jack hired the hit and killed her one true love. And after that, she demanded a divorce. She demanded half of everything he had in his business. And he gave her a no contest divorce after that. But he was very uneducated. And he needed her, because she knew how to run all the books. She was the business mind. So he readily agreed to have her, give her her divorce, but he's like, yes, I need you to stay as my business partner because I can't do this without you. And it seemed like it didn't matter what Jack did. He had this spot in his heart that Louise Hathcock could talk him into anything. You know, it seemed like he really cared for her and she never cared for him. And so that was the dynamic between the two. But anyways, she's having affairs with Towhead White by this time. Towhead White, we've already talked about. And Towhead White and her work out a scheme. She lures Jack back in the hopes of, you know, whatever, late at night to her hotel room. And Towhead's there waiting and he kills him. Jack dies in the parking lot of his own property. When the cops came, it happened to be the cop that Louise also messed around with and paid off a monthly salary to. He classed it as self-defense. Jack was there to beat her up again. And, you know, so poor, pitiful Louise, and she gets off scot-free. Nobody saw Towhead sneak out the back door kind of thing. So that's Jack and Louise Hathcock. Towhead is the one that has the ties with Kirksey Nix. It's believed that later on in a gun battle with Buford Pusser that ends up killing Louise, that Towhead is the one that hired the hit that caused the ambush on New Hope Road. So everything ties in together.
What happened? I know we're going a few minutes over here, but What happened with that shootout with Pusser and Louise? I guess she missed his head because she was drunk.
Yeah. Now, and there's a lot of conspiracy about that too, because some people say that if you go over the autopsy a certain way, that he shot her in the back. So that must mean that it wasn't self-defense, that he killed her. I also have looked at it. The same autopsy can be read however you want to read it. He shot her and it grazed here and it caused her to spin. So by the time the second bullet came off, it did come in the back. The first one hit here, she spun. The second one went here. The third, on her way down, it shot again. Okay. Supposedly, she shot first. So here's what the deal is. The whole concept, quick rundown. She had done the same routine to a group, a family called, their last name was Vogel, I think. And she had drugged them and robbed them. Well, they go to Buford Pusser, the police, and say what happened. Buford takes the Vogels and brings them back. And she identifies her belongings behind the counter. Louise Hathcock says, that's not your belongings. That's someone else's. And basically she says, come here, Buford. I need to have a personal word with you. So why this guy chose to do this, for one, I don't know. To me, that's kind of ignorant, putting yourself in a bad situation. But he followed her down the hall to room one, which is where she lived. She lived in the motel. She goes into the door first. She turns around, and by the time he comes into the doorway, she has her gun drawn. And supposedly, he walks in And, well, I have it backwards. He walks in first. She walks in behind him. When he comes, he turns around. She's in the doorway with her gun. Okay. And she shoots at him and misses. Well, she had been drinking for several days in a row, and she was about out of her mind drunk. And she shoots at him. She misses. It goes through the window. It hits the pole outside. There's all kinds of pictures and diagrams. He turns out, and he falls to the bed, and he shoots rapid fire three times. Bang, bang, bang. Okay. She hits the ground. She's done. Okay. Here's where the conspiracy comes in. Buford, they say Buford shot her first, that someone thinks they heard his gun go off before her gun. There's all kinds of conspiracies around that. But what that death led to was the fact that Towhead White was in jail. He wanted to hurt Buford the way Buford had hurt him. Now, everybody says in the public story is that he hired the hit on New Hope Road on Buford Pusser. But in reality, we know now that he hired the hit. He hired Kirksey Nix and his crew from Mississippi to hit Pauline because he wanted to kill Pauline so Buford hurt the way he did. And
because it's like he took his wife or his lover, right. So I'm going to take yours.
I'm going to take yours. And I kind of believe that because there's some evidence, obviously, but if you look at the psychology of these two men, they were both very roughneck guys. They were both, hard to the core. And honestly, one was on one side of the law, the other was on, but they were evenly matched with grit. They were evenly matched with, they both got off on this. I you hate to say that a sheriff got off on violence, but he did. I mean, they both enjoyed the war. They both enjoyed it way too much.
I was going to say real quick, I think to do that type of job, the sheriff job, there is a similarity to the criminals in so much as I think you would get an adrenaline rush from that line of work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you have to feel in that moment powerful. You know, you have to feel, so it's one of those things where it would be real easy to cross the line as a sheriff or in the other way. So I don't believe either one of them wanted to kill each other. They enjoyed the war. So it just kind of makes me think that that is true besides all the other evidence that I've collected. But anyways, that is how you go back all the way to Louise Hathcock and Jack Hathcock, all the way through the state line mob, through the Buford Pusser story, all the way 20 years later, the only people left in that whole saga is out of that whole group is Kirksey Nix. Kirksey Nix is the one that becomes what's now known as the Dixie Mafia, and he goes on to help hire the hit on a famous judge and his wife. And so it just continues on. It kind of migrates from the state line mob right into the Dixie Mafia as we know it.
Now, in closing, just real quick here, Phyllis Anderson, we spoke about her a little bit. What's the story of her search for justice with the death of her father and Ronnie Anderson? Because she's gone out of her way mm-hmm. to try to find justice. I think she tried to get FOIA documents, Freedom mm-hmm. of Information Act. Right. There's a whole other story there. I mean, there's so much we can cover.
Right. You have to just read the book to get that story, because this book is all about I told her, I said, I could write about Dixie Mafia stuff for eternity and not cover it all. So I made this book very short and succinct. It is solely in memory of her little brother. Her little brother was a 17-year-old polio victim who was just dying to be included with the guys. He just was seeking acceptance. He was developmentally, he was fine, but emotionally, he was very behind. Emotionally, development wise, he was very kind of immature and childlike because he never had that connection, that social connection with the other guys because of his handicap. He was in leg braces and whatever. The one night that the guys invite him out and have him borrow his dad's Cadillac, his dark colored Cadillac, is the time that they actually are going to run up to the state line and hit Buford Pusser and his wife. what we know now was they were the second car. They were the one that was actually watching the house. The plan was to use this little cripple boy because he was all innocent, didn't know what was going on. They were going to send him to knock on the door and lure Pauline out on the porch. Okay. Because she wouldn't be afraid of this little cripple boy. And she would open the door and then they were going to kill her there. He had no idea what was going on. He just thought he was going out with the guys. Well, as we know, history tells us that that was not what happened. She went with Buford. So they ended up, they were the second car that had chased him down. The first car that came out from behind the church hit him the first time. He did outrun him. The person that caught him was the second car. The second car was the one that had Kirksey Nix's crew in it. Also had a very scared Ronnie Anderson in the back seat while they plowed this car full of bullets. 6 weeks later, they kill the crippled boy because they don't want him to talk. And he was talking about going back and living with his sister for a while out of state. And they couldn't trust him to let him leave the town. And right after the death, that Cadillac disappears. We believe it's the one that Kirksey Nix blew up in front of the courthouse in Oklahoma. Also, it's come along through rumor mills or whatever stories that the ambush weapons were actually still in that car, and the father actually held on to them as insurance policy. And later on, the father was killed too. And so it's a long, drawn-out story, but they use this man's addiction to gambling to manipulate him into being involved in things he didn't want to be. And his involvement in these corrupt law enforcement tactics actually caused the death of his son. And so that is, Phyllis has fought for 54 years because both her brother and her dad were classed as suicide, even though all of the reports don't make sense. None of it adds up. There's massive holes in the whole thing. And yet no one wants to open it up. They're all classed as suicide. They're closed and no one wants to listen to her.
Did anything come out of the FOIA documents? I don't think so, right?
She honestly believes, and if you read the FOIA documents, which I have them all, it literally sounds like this person, whoever did it, went off of her Facebook page, copied everything down, all of the details she has collected, copied them all down word for word, and handed that to her as a FOIA request, because none of it correlates with the first document she got back at the beginning, and yet everything correlates exactly with what she's put on her own Facebook page. And so I don't have any proof of that, but it looks like it's a fabricated FOIA that's just telling her information right back to her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the Dixie Mafia, is it still around? And then I promise to let you go.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Yes, the Dixie Mafia is still around. I still believe that there are factions of it. If you talk to law enforcement or you research, they're like, oh, no, it's become something else now. It's this whole other gang. And but I still believe certain factions of this corruption is still out there. They call themselves something else now. And that first core of 220 people, most of them are dead and gone. Kirksey Nix is still in prison, but most of that core is gone. I talked to the son of one of those people in the Corps, and he was the one that told me he didn't believe Buford Pusser's accident was an accident. But that's the thing. I think the corruption is still there. The people might be gone, but I think some of the corruption is still there. It's just under a new name.
Well, I want to thank you, Sonova Cantrell, for coming on Parallax Views. Let my listeners know how they can get the book. And what do you think this story has to tell us in the current time? Do you think there's something to be learned from it? Do you think it ties into things we're seeing today in the world?
It definitely does, because there's so much, we've got all this news about police brutality, so you could always go off onto that tangent. You've also got all this corruption in our supposed to be law enforcement, corruption in our government, and corruption in this. So this is all about corruption.
Did you happen to see, there was a story last month about the LA Sheriff's Department and a gang working within the Sheriff's Department called the Executioners. That's why I said this does seem to tie into current things.
It does. And the thing is I always tell this, and I'm actually going to use this as I actually wrote it down in my notebook as a new book idea. We think that, you know, we've been trained to believe, you know, by all these movies out of Hollywood that there's going to be one person step up like the Lone Ranger and he's going to find justice for our case and going to and I find so many times there isn't that one person. And these victims' families are having to fight for justice on their own. And so I think as a community, we need to gather together. We need to rally around these people. We need to help. If you have ability to help, then help. Get the story out. You know, that's what I do. That's the reason why I've built Sonova Inc. up, because these people just need, you know, and a lot of times law enforcement may not be corrupt, but they're so understaffed, they're so underpaid, they're so overworked, they can't accomplish what they need to, even if they are, you know, good quality law enforcement. And all they need is some kind of, you know, clue to come in. They just need some little tip to come in. Most of these types of cases, they're solved by DNA or they're that somebody calls in a tip. And so that's the reason why I think as a community, we really need to rally around these cases and get people talking about them again. Because since I first wrote Phyllis's case on my blog, there's been people come forward and we've gotten a lot of information come forward since I first wrote about it, because I kicked up some dirt, you know, I kicked it up again into the media. And so that's what I think the lesson, the takeaway is. One, you know, these people have to fight on their own. There isn't just a Lone Ranger going to come save them. And two, we need to talk about these cases. We don't need to sweep them under the rug. You know, if we need reform in our country, not talking about it's not going to help anything, you know. And so that's kind of what this case is. My book's called Silence by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. You can buy it on Amazon right now.
Do you have that on hand? Can you show my listeners or my viewers of the Patreon the cover?
Yep.
That's a great cover.
Thank you. It says Silence by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. And it has a lot of personal photos in it from Phyllis Anderson. So you'll get to see a lot of things to do with the case. But it's on Amazon right now. It's potentially going to be picked up by a larger publishing house, hopefully. And if that works out, it will be in more mainstream bookstores as well. But, you can find all my stuff on Amazon. You can look me up at sonovainc.com or mytruecrimestories.com, and I'm all over social media.
Well, thank you again, Sonova Cantrell, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sonova Cantrell, author of Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time,
You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.